Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them, and not necessarily those of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters. Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. Hey, good evening, everybody. Welcome once again to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I'm Willie Hassel, along with the lovely, the mystical, the mysterious, Lynn Nickerson. Good evening.
Good evening, Willie. I think you forgot my name. Did you forget my name?
No, I said Lynn Nickerson.
Mm-hmm. You hesitated.
One of these days. No, I hesitated on mystical. But one of these days, though, I'm going to do that to you, just to see
how
what
are you
say.
Doing?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I'm great.
Do you believe this heat wave we've been having?
Yes.
Yeah. I hope it's over real soon.
You don't like it?
I've had enough of it.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Fine. Hey, you know what? We got a great guest tonight.
Yes, we do.
Well, do you want me to go ahead and introduce our great guest?
Please do.
Okay, I will do that. Tonight on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, we welcome to the show L. Santariga. L. has had his first UFO sighting at the age of 10 in Yonkers, New York, while stargazing with a friend. He had his first Bigfoot sighting at the age of 12 while visiting in Davies, Florida. He has since had many paranormal experiences, such as demonic, psychic, and even possible abduction. L is the founder of the Bronxville Paranormal Society, co-director of the North American Dogman Project, the New York State chapter, and co-director of the New York State UFO Project. And this is L's first appearance on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. So let's welcome to the show, L. Santariga. Good evening, L. How are you?
Hey, L.
Willie, hi, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for accepting.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about the Bronxville Society, the Paranormal Society. When did you start it, and how did you happen to get into that?
Well, the Bronxville Paranormal Society actually started off as a goof, to be honest with you. I was with a bunch of friends of mine at one of these ancient stone chambers we have here.
Oh yeah.
In New York, and all of us happened to work at the Bronxville Post Office, and a group of people seen us doing an investigation, and they asked us if we were a paranormal team. And I shouted out, yes, the Bronxville Paranormal Society, and the name stuck.
Huh.
And then I put a real team together, and we started doing our investigations.
Okay, so how long has that been since that period that you were in the Stone Chambers?
Oh, we've been together as a team about 5 years now.
Okay. So I don't want to get too involved in the stone chambers tonight, but I saw the pictures on your on the internet, on your site, and there were a lot of different hues and so forth. But did you sense anything rather than just your the physical photographic evidence? Did you sense anything while in there?
Yes. At a stone chamber at Ninham Mountain, I was doing a preliminary investigation, and I was actually scouting locations at the day, and I decided to just do like a preliminary investigation. And while I was in this one particular stone chamber, I felt a small, warm hand touch my right arm. And as I'm doing EVPs, I'm telling myself in my head, okay, Al, relax, calm down. This is what you're here for. And the image I got in my mind's eye was that it was a young Native American female.
Wow.
And I asked her how many stone chambers were in this particular area. And on my digital voice recorder, I got 17 taps. Later on, when I went and I researched the Chamber of Commerce in Putnam County, there were 17 chambers in that particular location.
Hmm.
Do you
have psychic abilities, Al?
No, I don't claim to be a psychic in any stretch of the imagination. I get gut feelings.
Yeah,
you've got intuition.
Yeah.
Yes. I've been told by a lot of psychics and Reiki masters and people of that realm that I have intuition or have psychic ability, but I'll never claim to have psychic ability. I just call it a gut feeling. I've had it my whole life.
Okay, well, psychic doesn't necessarily mean a prognosticator. It certainly does mean you can pick up on different energy levels than what most people do, and I think you do.
Yeah, I do. Like I said, we've been in a lot of different locations where, you get a feeling or another, and some will tell you that you're being watched, or maybe you shouldn't go in this particular location. You should back away. And I usually listen to my gut feelings when I get them.
Now, you go ahead, Billy.
But if somebody else tells you you shouldn't go, you go anyways, don't you?
Well, I'll be brutally honest with you. We do have a psychic on our team, and she does everything over the phone. She's from Arkansas. Her name is Cindy, and Cindy says I'm a conduit for her, and she can read me or other sites or locations through me. But we usually ask her ahead of time to get a read on the place, and if she tells us not to go, we won't go. We respect her judgment.
Okay, now what would be the conditions that she would suggest that you don't go?
Okay, well, we had one of our guys on the team suggested we go to these old ammunition tunnels in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, sounds like a good idea. They've been, around for since the 40s. And Cindy, usually, as soon as we start talking about something, she'll start to get feelings. And she called me up and she said, what are you guys planning? Because I'm having a really bad vibes about this place. I'm seeing really dark and demonic things, and maybe you shouldn't go to where you're going. And she actually described a creature that she's seen she didn't know what it was, but when she described it to me, I said, it sounds like a Native American Wendigo. And when she went and looked it up online, she said, that's exactly what I seen in my mind's eye.
And that's unusual.
Don't go to that location. So we never went.
Well, would you please repeat that to Willie and tell him there are demonic entities and you shouldn't mess with them?
No, it wasn't that. I wasn't sure what you called it, Native American.
You're changing the subject. No. The point is, there are some demonic entities and there are places that you shouldn't go, like insane asylums and jails.
But that's a subject for another day.
That's another subject.
I've never been to jail, and I don't want to be, but no.
Now or never.
No. I've never been in a working jail.
But we have done insane asylum.
Yeah.
I still think they're dangerous, too, because there's so much tragedy that happened there. There's a lot of negativity hanging around.
Yeah, see,
don't you agree?
Me and Lynn, we have disagreement on this. So insane asylums and old jails like, Moundsville Penitentiary. But
Sure.
Okay, but the Wendigo, would you explain to our audience exactly what that is?
Okay, that's what I was trying to ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a Native American demon. That's what it is.
Oh, it is a demon. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, that is amazing. Well, I hate to depart this subject. This is really interesting, too. But there are a couple of other things we wanted to talk about tonight. And I don't think the audience is aware of all of the variety of encounters that you have had and the types of experience, one of them being the dog man. And you also think that perhaps you might have been abducted and you started having experiences as a child. So it just kind of says to me that you're pretty sensitive. So I listened to several of your radio shows, as Willie and I both did. And the one that, there are several that really got to me. The very first one, though, did happen to be the story of the postman in Bronx or Yonkers?
No, it was in North Yonkers, yeah.
North Yonkers, okay. And absolutely, it's a frightening story.
It is.
And I was hoping that maybe that you could repeat it tonight for our audience.
Absolutely.
Wonderful,
that's
okay.
That's the one you want to talk about. We'll talk about that, sure.
Yeah, we'll start there.
Yeah, we'll start there.
Okay. It was 1989. I just got hired by the post office in North Yonkers. Yonkers is a big city. It's like the fifth largest city in New York State. It has a lot of post offices, and I happen to be in the North End. And I was going out with a senior carrier. That's what they usually do when they train you, to send you out for a week with a senior guy. And they have a week or two, and they have you trained. And one day, this gentleman, Sam, I'll call him Sam, because this is a story 30 years in the making, because I haven't been able to talk about it because everybody was still on the jobs. Now
yeah.
that he's retired, I could actually talk about it. Sam, we were having lunch one day on the route, and he goes on and he tells me the story about his best friend, Mike. And he tells me, like, Mike did a 28 route. That was the number of the route, and he was, like, on that route for 10, 15 years, and he knew everybody, and it's a very high-end area of Yonkers, North Yonkers. There's a lot of professionals in that area, doctors and lawyers and such, and everything was going good, and he was delivering to the David Berkowitz's building. David Berkowitz, son of Sam, the 44 caliber killer back in the 80s. He was a serial killer, and he was from Yonkers. And he was delivering to David Berkowitz's building, and he knew all the residents in the building. And like I said, it's a high-end building, doorman, mm-hmm. the whole nine yards. And one day he was down in the garage using the facilities when this guy, Mike, he heard what he thought was chanting coming from the garage. And this was on Halloween. So he started hearing this chant, and he couldn't really understand what was going on inside the garage, but he heard this chanting. And when he opened up the bathroom door to exit, he seen four men in hoods, and they were around a circular fire in the shape of a pentagram with black smoke billowing out of it. And out of this black smoke, this gray smoke came out of it. And I don't know if it was a demon or the devil or what it was, but this thing, when it appeared, went straight over to Mike and told him, for what you've seen here today, I'll have your soul. And, of course, Mike absolutely freaked out, went back to the post office, told the boss what was going on, and took a leave of absence for like 6 months. And while he was on this leave of absence, life just crashed and burned for this poor guy. He became an alcoholic. He lost his wife, left him, took the kids and left them. The bank took the house. And it just seemed like he was, you know, going to a really bad time, and he was just crashing and burning. And at one point, another route opened up on one of the central stations. We'll call it the central station. And he was able to bid on a route on the central station. And once he got to that route, everything started to change for him. His life got better. He stopped becoming an alcoholic. And He got an apartment on the route. Again, this was a really nice area as well. And he got familiar with all the people on the route, and he was getting back together with his wife and kids, and everything was going great. And he's delivering this route for a whole month. Now, when Sam is telling me the story, he doesn't know, because I'm not really sure if Sam is pulling my leg or telling me the truth at this point. And I'm a newbie, and, you know, sometimes newbie guys get taken like that. But he doesn't know that my brother-in-law works at that particular station, and I'm going to check everything out with my brother-in-law when I get home that night. And so he goes on, and he's been there for the whole summer, and there everything is going great. And towards the end of the summer, he starts getting to this one street. It's a little street. It had like four houses on it, and it was like a meadow at the end of the block with a big oak tree in it. And he started getting to the last house on the block, and there was every day there was a black cat waiting for him, and it attacked him every day. Ooh. And he would spray the cat with the dog spray, but it had no effect on the cat. So he stopped delivering the people's mail. So eventually the people called the post office and spoke to the supervisor and said, you know, we're not getting, you know, Mike's not delivering our mail anymore. We don't know what's going on, but we haven't gotten mail in a week. And the manager said, okay, I'll talk to the carrier when he gets back. And in the meantime, my brother-in-law was Mike Slaughter. He did the route when Mike was off. So they asked my brother-in-law, are you having any issues with this house? My brother-in-law says, no, you know, when I do the route, I always deliver it. I don't have a problem. They talked to the truck driver, Joe, and they said, you know, when you deliver packages to that house, do you have any issues? And the guy said, Joe says, I've been delivering packages there for 20 years. I never have any issues. I drop the packages off in front of the door. So one Saturday, the boss decides he's going to take the mail out, deliver the mail to these people to see what's, you know, talk. Because he talks to Mike, and Mike says, listen, it's not my fault that they started leaving their cat out outside. And the cat has been attacking me every time I go there. The dog spray has no effect on this thing. It's a really big black cat, and I don't know what to do. You know, maybe should I start leaving the mail in the neighbor's box or something like that? You know, and so the supervisor goes out to talk to these people one Saturday when everybody's home, and knocks on the door, and he explains to them, says, "Listen, you know, during the week, if you want your mail, you got to keep your cat inside." and they started laughing. They said, "We don't even own a cat. We don't know what you're talking about." So he says, "Well, Mike's telling me every day when he gets here, there's a big black cat waiting for him that attacks him." So this is going on for a couple of weeks, and every day this cat is waiting for him. So he starts. So what he did was he set up a box at the neighbor's house where he would put their mail in, and these people would just go next door. It's only like 5 feet away anyway, and get their mail there because he couldn't get to their house. So all of a sudden, one day, as he's delivering the mail, the cat starts talking to Mike.
That is so creepy.
And the cat's telling Mike, you know, by the end of the summer, I'll have your soul. So Mike's freaking out. You know, he starts to freak out. He's like, you know, now if you know anything about David Berkowitz, and Berkowitz lived in that building,
mm-hmm.
Sam was the neighbor's dog who lives behind his building. And he said Sam was talking to him, telling him to kill people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you have the dog telling Berkowitz, then you have the cat telling the mailman that he's going to take his soul. So he tells my brother-in-law, he says, listen, you know, the cat is talking to me. So my brother-in-law says, wow, this guy's, you know, really losing it, you know. My brother-in-law talks to the truck driver, Joe, because they're really good friends. And he says, have you ever seen this cat? They're like, no. He says, well, this cat's talking to Mike, you know. And they're thinking that Mike's cracking up.
Yeah.
Anyway, end of the summer comes. It's a Saturday, and Mike never comes back to the station. Supervisor wants to close it, lock up to go home, and the Mike's nowhere to be found. And so the truck driver is usually the last guy to get in. So he tells Joe, do me a favor and go to Mike's route and see if you find him out there. Find out what's taking us so long to get back. I want to go home. So Joe jumps in his truck, and he knows where the end of Mike's route is. So he goes right to that neighborhood. That dead-end street is like the last neighborhood on his route. He goes to that dead-end street, and as he's pulling down the street, there's Mike hanging from that oak tree with the carry sack wrapped around his neck, hanging there.
Wow.
And, you know, Joe freaks out, and he goes to the first business that he comes to. He calls the cops. He calls the post office. The cops come. They take him down out of the tree, but it was too late for Mike. Mike had already passed.
Oh.
And, you know, so, you know, whatever that cat was, it was, obviously it wasn't a cat.
Yeah.
Mm. That is a creepy story.
But there's more to it, isn't there?
Yes. And, you know, so after, you know, Sam tells me the story, of course, I go home and I call my brother-in-law. And, I'm expecting to hear, what are you talking about? What are you, nuts? And my brother-in-law validated the whole story. He said, yeah. He said, you know, did you know that guy? And I said, no, I never met him. But, you know, I was working with his best friend and told me the story, and I thought the guy was pulling my leg. And he said, no, he said, I was his floater. I did that route, and said, it really happened. And I was like, holy, holy. So time goes by, and getting back to the North Station, 28 route is vacant because the regular carrier took over for Sam, for Mike, is injured. So I'm an unassigned regular, so they put me on the route, and they say, okay, we want you to do this route every day. Hold it down for as long as it takes. Just do me a favor. Don't use the bathroom in the basement. As a matter of fact, I don't want you going down into the basement for anything. Now, this particular building had a beautiful Olympic-sized pool in the backyard where the women and the children would be all day during the summer. They had barbecues and ice cream parties and soda and all kinds of stuff, little tiki bar. And and my boss said, I don't want you going down there to deliver any kind of accountable mail.
And
either let them come.
And let me ask you, that pool was on the basement level, or was there a basement beneath that?
No. To get to that pool, you would have to take the elevator down to the garage, walk through the garage, out to the backyard where the pool was.
Okay.
So the bathroom that was in the garage was used
on that level,
the pool's bathroom.
Okay. And the fire had been in the garage on that level then, right? When they were doing that ritual.
Yes, on that first level, yeah.
Okay. So you're warned not to go down to the garage. Don't go into the cellar. Go ahead.
So, you know, like I said, this is a really, really big building, and it gets a lot of mail, and he gets a lot of accountable stuff. But as time went on and I got to know the people, and I was there quite a while, I became very comfortable with the people. And I would go down into the basement to deliver accountable mail or packages. If the doorman said, oh, they're down at the pool, you know, just go down there, they'll sign for it. I would go down there. I never had an issue. And I'd be brutally honest, I used that bathroom all the time during that particular summer I was on the route. Never had an issue.
You're kidding.
And they treated me very well there. They gave me free food for lunch and soda, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they were very, very nice to me. So summer comes and goes, and the fall rolls around, and Halloween comes, and I have to use the bathroom.
Ooh.
And normally the doorman is around, and I can use the bathroom in the doorman's office, but he was nowhere to be found on Halloween. So then I went to the super department. I rang his bell, and he was nowhere to be found. And so I said, you know what? I have no choice in the matter. I have to go downstairs. I have to use this bathroom. You know, what's the big deal? I've used it 100 times during the course of the summer. Never had any issues. So I go down. It's maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that. I go down doing my business, and I start hearing chanting.
Hmm.
Now, you know, all of a sudden, I'm getting a flashback from Sam's story about Mike. And I start to hear the chanting, and I was like, oh, no, man. You know, this can't be happening. I got a whole route to do, and this is like, you know, just the beginning of the first quarter of the route. And I'm sitting in the bathroom, and I got my back against the door. I got the door locked. I got the light off. I'm not coming out of that bathroom. And so at one point, I crack the door to see what's going on. And there, in the middle of the garage, are six people in hoods around a fire, black smoke billowing out of it. It looked like to me to be in the shape of a pentagram, mm-hmm. and the smoke was billowing out of it. And I closed the door very gently, and I locked the door, and I said, "I'm not coming out of this bathroom." And I stood in that bathroom for about an hour and a half or so.
Why didn't the fire alarm go off? Maybe there wasn't one?
You know what? That's a good question. I don't think there was a fire alarm, but, you know, I don't even know if there was a sprinkler system in the garage.
It's strange.
I don't really remember if there was or not. But
fire and smoke and not disturbing somebody, you know? But yeah, I think I know why, but
I guess maybe that particular floor didn't have anything. I don't know. I just never noticed anything mm-hmm. up on the ceiling before. You know, I just never looked closely, I guess.
So you were there an hour and a half in the bathroom.
The super comes down. He sees the mailboxes are open and all the mail's in front of the mailboxes. So he figures I'm in the building somewhere. He can't find me in the building delivering packages, so he comes down, he knocks on the door, and he says, "Al, it's Jose." And I said, "Hey, Jose, what's going on?" He said, "Are you okay?" He thought I was locked in the bathroom. I was stuck. You know, and he says, "You know, we'll get the door open for you. We'll get you out." And I was like, "No, I can get out. Is everything okay out there?" And he's like, "Yeah, everything is fine. What's going on?" So I open the door, and I bring him over to the grounds where the people were doing their chanting or whatever they were doing. And there's no indication on the garage floor that there was ever a fire there.
Hmm.
But up on the ceiling was a lot of soot from the black smoke that was billowing out. So I showed that to Jose, and he said, "Oh, well, I got to get down here and clean it before the residents get home from work, because they'll go crazy. You know, this building is very high maintenance and yada, yada, yada." So after a little while, I became good friends with Jose, and I asked him to show me David Berkowitz's apartment.
How did you dare go in there?
Because I really wanted to see it for myself. And he was up like on the fourth or fifth floor. And we get up, and as we're going up in the elevator, and they don't use this apartment anymore for anything. They're supposed to use it for storage, but Jose won't even go in there. He doesn't even use it for storage. And we get up and we're going up in the elevator and everything is okay. The closer you get to his floor, the heavier the air is getting. And it's real. By the time that elevator door opened up, it was so heavy that you could have cut it with a knife. And then I'm walking down the corridor, a long corridor, to go to his apartment, because it's all the way at the end of at the corner corridor. Jose opens up the door. He lets me in, and I go into the foyer. I go into the kitchen, into the bathroom. I go into the living room. The living room windows overlook the pool. I go into the bedroom. The bedroom windows overlook the pool. Again, they overlook the pool. They overlook the street behind it where Sam, who was a Yonkers cop, mm-hmm. and his dog was a retired police dog, was a German Shepherd, was always at that gate, because that particular street was all rear deliveries, and you delivered it from the back, and everybody's mailbox was at the top of the steps. Because they didn't have a front to their street, because the aqueduct ran in front of their house.
Oh, okay.
They built the aqueduct. They ran in front, so they made this private street for them and everybody. So the dog was always up at the top of the steps by the mailbox, by the fence, and could look right up into Berkowitz's apartment.
Mm.
So Jose wouldn't come in, and I'm thinking to myself, this place feels so evil that how do the people on either side of this apartment, or the people above him or below him, live here? Can't they feel the presence of evil? Because it felt like evil was in that apartment.
Al, could you stop there for just a second? We're going to have to do a bottom of the hour break, and we're going to come right back, and we'll pick up where we left off, okay? We'll be right
Absolutely.
Back. Thank you.
And Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, on WSCA 106.1 FM in Portsmouth's West End.
Leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener, the light was brighter.
Yeah, welcome back to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. And tonight we are talking to L. Santariga, the founder of the Bronxville Paranormal Society. Welcome back, sir.
Hi, Al.
Al.
Thank you for having me tonight. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We're sitting on the edge of our seats here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And before we move on, I just want to mention, if anybody wants to ask you a question or make a comment or something, they can text us at 603-430-9722.
Okay, Al, so you were in Berkowitz's apartment and you're checking it out and you're feeling that it's really very evil.
Yeah, it had a dark feeling to it, and like I said, I don't understand how people in the building who lived in the vicinity of that apartment didn't feel that energy. But then I started to think about it, and I started thinking about the Berkowitz case and how he was connected to a cult that hung out in this park across the street from his house called Untermeyer's Park in North Yonkers. It was very famous for devil worshiping, and it had a lot of dark history to it. And so to me, it just made sense. I mean, I started thinking, well, if those people I seen that day in the basement with the hoods were summoning something, and then I opened the door and they were gone, they had to go somewhere. So I'm assuming that they were residents of the building. You know what I mean? And I think
I do. And I agree with you, because oft times it is some of these really wealthy people that are into this for power.
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%. And, you know,
Al, haven't you thought back, the people that were giving you all that food at the pool, don't you think that maybe some of those families might have been those involved?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe not the women and children. But
their families. Sure. Yeah, their husbands or whatever. Yep. I was thinking that, too, in retrospect. You must have come to that realization.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. Because, like I said, when I opened that door the second time and those six hooded figures were gone, they didn't just disappear and up in smoke. They had to go somewhere.
Yeah, so it's a high-security building.
Yeah, I mean, it was a high-end building. It was a very high-end. And I just think they went upstairs or up. I don't think they took the elevator. I think they must have went up the stairs and back into their apartment.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and this
really do.
This was something that happened obviously on more than one occasion. So you'd think that neighbors would have complained unless they were all in on it too.
Yeah. So Al, I can't remember what point you met that older lady that was trying to rent out the apartment in the building.
So around the corner from the Berkowitz building was a private residence, a little old Polish woman. She was a sweetheart, and her mailbox was up, was down on the first floor. There was a first floor apartment, and her mail. But I used to go up the steps every day and put her mail between the door because she was old and I didn't want her coming down the steps and falling and getting hurt.
Oh, yeah.
So I would always go and deliver the mail up to her apartment, up the front door. So every day she would have like a glass of lemonade or iced tea or some piece of cake waiting for me because she was taking care of me for taking care of her. And then I told her about, I said, you know, this area has got such a bad vibe to it. And I told her, I said, explain to her what happened to me in the building. And she said, oh, you don't know what happened here. And I said, well, what happened here? And she said, a long time ago, I had a young couple move into the basement of the first floor apartment, and everything was going great for the first 2 or 3 years. And then the husband got hooked up with that devil worshiping cult from the park. And they started practicing it in his apartment. And apparently at one point, his wife got pregnant and was ready to have the baby. And he invited this cult. And we were both surmised that they were going to take the baby and sacrifice it. Because the wife was fighting with the husband and the rest of the cult. And she heard them fighting downstairs, screaming and yelling. She heard the wife screaming bloody murder. She thought that the woman was being killed. And she called the cops, and the cops came in and kicked in the door and arrested everybody. And the woman was rescued by the police, and nothing ever happened to the child. But after the husband was locked up, the wife moved out. She moved back with her parents. And the old lady went downstairs to clean the apartment, to rent the apartment, and she just got like a really bad vibe, like something was in there. And at night, she would be upstairs in her apartment. She would hear banging on the walls or banging in the walls or on the ceilings. She would look out the window, and the light would always be on the first floor, like somebody was in the kitchen, but there was nobody in the apartment. And she tried to rent it out to, this was a very dominant Polish community, and she tried to rent it out to, you know, some other Polish immigrants that were coming over, and none of them would take the apartment. So apparently at one point she met a priest that was visiting her church from Poland, and she brought him to the house, and he did an exorcism, and he cleansed that apartment. And after he cleansed her apartment, you could just feel the energy in the place was so much lighter. Mm-hmm. The apartment just felt so much lighter, and she never had any more issues with bangs and lights going on and stuff like that. And she was able to rent the apartment out eventually, but...
Yeah, she was trying to get you to rent it, wasn't she?
Yeah, she wanted me to take the apartment of me and my wife, and she wanted us to move in, and it was a great apartment. I would have loved to move in. It had a phone parking spot and everything, but we already had a nice apartment on the other side of town, so, you know, we weren't going to leave our apartment and move in with there.
But, Al, doesn't this remind you of Rosemary's Baby a little bit, this whole scenario?
Sorry, yes. Somebody always brings up Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is it. Those things really happen. And when was that, 69 or early 70s that came out?
Yeah, that was a long time ago, that movie. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to watch that movie.
You're going to have to watch it.
I've
it's
never
frightening.
Seen it. Never seen it.
And
oh, yeah, you have to see Rosemary's Baby. That was a great movie.
Yep. Well, now I got to see it, yeah.
And the fact that the husband was involved with these people, and then he decides that he would like to offer the baby to them, it's just very, very, very similar and very creepy. Okay,
yeah,
sorry for interrupting.
In that park, that optimized park, I sent you the link to the park. I don't know if you had a chance to look through it.
I read the whole thing.
And did you see all the photographs of the devil worshipping stuff down in the
carriage house or whatever that was? Yeah. Very, very strange.
Yeah.
You just can't purge a place like that. So much has happened there. They sacrificed animals.
Yeah. My brother used to work at the hospital right across the street, and his office was up on the top floor of the hospital, and he worked nights. And he used to say he could see bonfires going there on the weekends, Friday nights and Saturday nights. He said, and he just knew that they were doing like work, devil worshiping and sacrificing animals and stuff.
Good place to stay away from. You had said that you had gone there with your wife. You were dating her at the time, and you had a strange experience with a gargoyle that you couldn't see.
Oh, it was crazy. 1987, my wife and I were dating, and we went to the park for a picnic, and we had a beautiful sunny day, and we had a beautiful picnic, and it was a nice day. And my wife had asked me at the end of the day, she said, do you know where the devil worshipping caves were? You know, and I said, yeah, I know where they are. She goes, well, why don't you show them to me? So I said, okay. So as we started to head towards the back of the park. They have these steps they call the Thousand Steps that go from the one end of the park to the other. And the aqueduct runs right along the middle of these steps. And as we started walking towards the back of the park, this beautiful sunny day got really dark and windy, and it turned very ominous, and it was creepy. And we both got a really bad vibe, but we were going anyway. And as we started to go down the steps, we got about maybe halfway down the steps. We were coming to the aqueduct. You have to get off the steps and take the aqueduct into the woods to get to the caves. And we were coming down, and we heard a whoosh go over our heads, like a big bird just came down over our heads. And we both ducked. We both ducked, and we looked up, and there was nothing above us. And the wind was blowing, and the trees were spinning around in circles. It was really weird. And we both got the feeling that there was something on the aqueduct staring back at us. You couldn't see anything there. There wasn't anything that you could see.
But you got a mental image.
We felt that there was something there. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, you know what? Forget about the caves today. I'll show you the bird cage. Now, I believe they refer to the bird cage in that link I sent you to the crow's nest. Mm-hmm. But we called it, in the neighborhood, the kids called it the bird cage because it looked like a giant bird cage. So I said, okay. So she goes, okay, show me the bird cage. So we turn around, we go back up the steps, and we're walking on a paved road now that the Parks Department uses to drive the trucks on to pick up the garbage cans and stuff like that. And we're on this road, and we're headed south, actually towards the Berkowitz building. We're headed south, and as we're walking down the road, again, we hear this big whoosh come over our heads, and again, we both duck. At this point, there's this giant oak tree to our right with a very large branch that goes across the road. But it's high up there. It's got to be 30, 40 feet up in the air. And we're both looking up at this giant branch. Again, you can't see anything on the branch. There's nothing there to see. But we're both getting the feeling that there's something there. So I turn to her and I say, what do you see? And she says, do you remember the old cult classic movie, The Gargoyles? And I started laughing. I said, absolutely, I love that movie. It was a cheesy 70 movie that they made for TV back in the old days. But I told her, I said, that's the same image that I got in my mind, too, where we were both seeing the same gargoyle devil-like image in our head up on that branch, but there was nothing there that we could see with our own two eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I just said, let's get out of this park. And we left that park, and we never went back. And to this day, we've never been back.
I remember that Brian Bowden had asked you, would you go back and investigate? And you answered, what?
I said, under the right circumstances, I think I would. I would.
But probably not.
I would have to get my okay from the psychic. You know, first
yeah.
I would have to say it was okay to go there. And then when we got there, I would have to see how my gut felt. If my gut said, don't go in, I wouldn't go in. But if the gut said, go ahead, go for it, I would do it. So,
yep.
You know.
It's good that you're cautious. That is really important.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, a lot of, Brian's not the only guy on the team that wants to go to that bar. Everybody wants to go there because of the history, you know?
Yeah.
But it's such a dark history that I really don't like to play with that stuff, like that demonic stuff is
really
my pay grade, you know?
It's not good being exposed to it. I think leave well enough alone.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said it's probably best to leave well enough alone.
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%.
Now, you were talking to Arizona Tramp, Paul, about the what you thought might have happened in the garage. And, you know, I'm kind of in agreement with him because both times that the ceremony was witnessed, someone had gone into the bathroom and it was Halloween. And I think that passing through the bathroom, maybe it's the door, maybe it's the bathroom itself that may act as a trigger that opens up a portal. I think there's some kind of a double dimension going on. Didn't you mention that there was nobody around at all both times?
Yeah, it's like I said, this building is a very high-end building, and they always dress the building up for all the holidays, Thanksgiving,
yeah.
Valentine's Day. And it was just funny to me. There was a lot of children in that building. This is really a huge building. It's got a north end and a south end, and it's like two buildings combined as one. And it was strange to me that they would decorate for every other holiday under the sun, but they never decorated for Halloween.
Oh, and they never did. I didn't realize
that. No, not even in a community room. They never had anything set up
that
for the kids or
anything.
That is odd.
Yeah, that kind of tells you something right there, I think.
Yeah. I think something's going on. I have no doubt that you witnessed something was real, but I am wondering if it was kind of like Paul mentioned, a time loop of some kind. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it could have been a time-space continuum, something like that, or a doorway to a different dimension on that particular day, on that particular time. I don't know. You know, I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy, you know. I see things black and white, so, you know, that stuff is beyond me.
It does make a lot of sense, though, because in both cases, you and the other person had just gone into the bathroom, and couldn't have been a matter of just a couple of minutes.
Right.
They come out and already this fire is going. So,
yeah,
you know,
and it's already going.
So that does make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in theory, it does make sense. Absolutely.
Another possibility.
I mean, like I said, I don't know how fast these people got there to start the fire, and I don't know where they went when they left. And I never heard anybody leave.
Ian, how do you not leave cinders?
Walk away.
How do you not leave cinders as a trace on the garage floor? How do you do that?
Yeah, but yet they left
the smoke on the ceiling.
On the ceiling, yeah.
Very odd. Well, that's about the end of that postman story, but there were a couple of other things I was hoping we could get into. I did want to maybe continue a little bit with the stone chambers. You've had so many incredible experiences. Why did you decide to investigate the stone chambers?
Well, first of all, nobody really knows who built these stone chambers.
Right.
I mean, if you ask the historians, they say they're
root cellars
yeah. for the colonial times. And there's no way these things are root cellars. The colonial people didn't even build their houses out of stone. Why would they build a root cellar out of stone? And if you see the size of the stones that were used, they're,
huge.
At least 2-3 tons. These stones are humongous.
Yep, those top stones are very, very large.
Very large for the roofs, absolutely. And it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're in one of these things that are on a main road in the sun, or if you're in one of these things that are in the woods underneath the tree canopy, they're always 68 degrees inside.
68?
68 degrees inside,
yeah. That's interesting. Also, Al, when you took some video inside the stone chambers, and there was like this hazing of color in there, and I couldn't quite figure what was going on, but it was like swirling of temperature changes, wasn't it? And it went up to 90 plus degrees at one point.
Oh, yeah, when I went during the day, and my brother told me to bring my night vision goggles. And I said, why would I bring night vision goggles if I'm going during the day? And the doorways are 6 feet, like a normal doorway, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, there's plenty of light that goes in. And he says, do me a favor, bring your night vision goggles. So I said, okay. So I brought my night vision goggles, and we went in there, and we took pictures, and we did EVPs, and we did all kinds of stuff. And just as we were about to leave, I said, oh, let me try my night vision goggles. And when I put my night vision goggles on and I turned them on, we got writing on the back of the walls that looked like Viking runes.
Whoa.
But you couldn't see it. You could only see it in IR light or UV light. You couldn't see it with the naked eye, and it wouldn't come out on a regular film if you took a picture of it, or if you looked at it with a flashlight and you took it, it would just look like the regular back of the stone. But when you took a picture with it with like an IR camera or a UV camera, a full spectrum camera, it will come out, and you'll see these runes that go right across the back of a wall, which was pretty amazing. Everybody was like, no, you know, I've read a lot of books on these chambers, and I've never read anything about anyone finding these invisible letters.
No.
You know? So that was pretty amazing.
What do you think was used?
I don't know. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on in the ancient times where they used invisible ink, you know what I mean? That only showed up under certain light or under if you held it underneath a piece of paper. So I honestly don't know what was on the back of those stones, what it was written in. I don't know what language it was. We went and we looked up all kinds of ancient writings from Viking runes to hieroglyphics to Egyptian hieroglyphics to all kinds of stuff. And it kind of matched a little bit of everything. It was pretty strange how it, you know, kind of looked like it matched a little bit of everything, especially from the Middle East. It was crazy. And the picture you're talking about is we went into one of the stone chambers and we did a Geiger counter reading. Mm-hmm. And the Geiger counter read there was no radiation in the chamber. So what we did was we used a Tibetan singing bowl.
Oh.
And we filled the chamber with frequency and vibration. And then after we used the Tibetan singing bowl, we filled the chamber with vibration. We did another Geiger counter reading because they say, at least David Roundtree says, when a portal opens up, radiation level goes through the roof.
Oh.
So we did another reading, and the radiation was through the roof. So what we did is we started filming and taking pictures in IR, and that's where we got all that color variation, like the swirling color, and how it went up from 68 degrees to 91 degrees. But it was only 91 degrees on the temperature reading on the camera. The temperature didn't change to us, but we were in there. We didn't feel any temperature change.
How can you account for that?
I can't. I don't know how.
But
that
happened. But that's enigmatic.
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt you, Al, but we technically only have about 5 minutes left till the 11 o'clock. However, there's a lot of stuff that we want to talk to you about, like Nuclear Lake and stuff like that.
God.
And it just happens there isn't any show coming on after us. Could you possibly stay over extra half hour, maybe?
Absolutely, sure.
Oh, good. All right, okay.
All right, that'd be great. We got about 4 more minutes till we take the top of the hour break. So go ahead.
Okay,
so this swirling stuff was showing different temperature changes. What do you think that was? Obviously, an increase in the radiation, but what about the portal aspect of it?
Yeah, I think that the infrared camera, when it was filming, it was actually filming the portal
opening.
I don't know if it was opening or closing, but in the midst of one or the other.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's just my theory. You know,
I'm
sure it is.
Well, that's what this all is. We really don't know for sure, do we?
No.
I just find the whole topic of stone structures very intriguing. So what is your personal feeling about maybe the purpose of some of these stone chambers?
Well, I think that they were used for some kind of ceremonial chambers. You know, I called the psychic, and she told me that they were, which the way she seen it, was that they were built by white men in robes thousands and thousands of years ago, and they were used for ceremonial things, events, or whatever. And she also felt that there was probably human sacrifice in some of them.
Mm.
And she also felt that the Native Americans may have used it as an offering space to their, you know, ancestors or whatever,
yep.
gods or whoever they you know, worshipped, whatever. But she thinks that the Native Americans definitely used them as well. But she doesn't believe that the Native Americans built them. And I've spoken to a couple of Native American tribes in this region, like the Iroquois and the Mohegans, the Mohawks, and there was another one I can't remember. And none of them built with stone.
No, they didn't.
They don't claim to have built them. They say these things were here when we got here.
Yep, they kind of repurposed them or used them as they were.
Right.
Wow. You know, it's interesting that Cindy mentioned the white robes, because Willie and I went to America's Stonehenge in North Salem, New Hampshire, and we did a documentary there. And I got some definite impressions while I was there, and I kept seeing not men but women in white robes that were to be sacrificed, and that the men that were in white robes were spectators watching the spectacle of the sacrifice.
Yeah, we were invited to do the American Stonehenge.
Were you?
We just never got a chance to get up there.
It's a bit of a drive, I would think.
Yeah.
So how many chambers were you in, Al? Or investigating?
I think when it was all said and done, we investigated about 8 or 9.
Wow.
But there, like I said, there's, according to the Chamber of Commerce book for Putnam County, there's like 91 of them throughout the whole county.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And a lot of them have been knocked down to build roads and houses and stuff like that. So,
do you think there's some kind of a communication network going on between them? This one woman, Barbara DeLong, she kind of feels that they were set up to be in synchronization with each other, as if on a ley line. And they
I definitely believe they were built on ley lines.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would agree with that, because, like I said, when I went in there and I did my investigation, I used the very first time I used a military compass. And on the outside of that chamber, you know, it pointed to magnetic north every single time. When I went inside, just the doorway of the chamber, it spun like a top.
Oh, my gosh.
It seems like the doorway holds more energy than the center of the chamber. And in one of the chambers, there's actually an altar in the back.
And how do you know it's an altar?
Well, it's built like it's an altar. We call it an altar, but
like a level.
I mean, we don't know for sure. But there's actually two chambers. That one is called the Queen's Chamber. One is called the King's Chamber. And the King's Chamber is humongous.
Hmm.
I mean, it makes all the other chambers in the area look tiny. It's like four times the size of a normal chamber. And there was another chamber that Cindy told me. We were going up one time, and she said, there's one chamber that has dark energy in it, and you really shouldn't go in it. And there's two guys on the team that are not allowed for you to go on this investigation because they have subconscious fear, and whatever in this chamber is not bound to that chamber or those woods. It can go wherever it wants. And I'm afraid these two guys may get
affected.
Excuse me, possessed or something.
Yeah.
So we had to leave two guys behind. And when we went to that particular chamber, it was very odd. It was shaped like a dome. It was round, not square. It had a doorway that was only 3 feet high, when all the other ones are 6 foot.
Bigger. Yeah, Al, I'm going to have to interrupt you for just a second here. We're going to have to do a top of the hour break.
Yep.
And we'll come right back, and then we continue with our discussion.
Thank you.
We are going to go a little bit overtime tonight. Guest tonight is Our guest tonight is El Santariga. He is the founder of the Bronx Paranormal Society, and we are really happy that he has agreed to stick around for another half hour. So, there he is. Hello, El. Hello. Welcome back.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I forgot to push your button.
Yeah. We're so glad you can stay for a little bit longer. Thank you.
Absolutely. No problem.
Okay, so we're talking about the King of the Queen's Chamber, and this is a domed chamber. Whereabouts is this located in Putnam County again?
This is located in right off of Route 301 in Putnam County.
Okay. So, now, she was saying that she felt that there was something evil in the King's Chamber.
No, this wasn't neither one of the King of the Queen's Chamber. This was just another chamber.
Oh, another one.
That
oh,
was
okay.
Built like a dome. It was rounded. It has a had a totally different build. And like I said, the doorway was only 3 feet high. And this mm-hmm. this chamber actually has a backstory. An investigator, Phil Imbrogno, was investigating these chambers back in the '80s, and mm-hmm. he interviewed two people who live right across the street from the chamber. And one of them was walking his dog along the road at night, like at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And he seen two 3 foot tall hooded figures with red eyes going to the chamber.
Oh, geez.
And this guy got so scared, he picked his dog up and he ran back home. A couple of months later, one of the guys from the neighborhood was walking home late at night from a friend's house. And he's seen two hooded figures with red eyes go into the chamber. He thought it was a couple of teenagers going in there to do devil worshiping or whatever.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, not on my watch. And he went in there, and this is a big guy, 25-year-old guy, whatever he was. And he went in there and to chase these kids out, and there was nobody there. And he had his flashlight with him, and he's looking around, and he couldn't understand why there was. He seen two figures go in, but he said, where did they go? And then all of a sudden, he said he was attacked.
Ooh.
Something grabbed him in a headlock and threw him against the wall. He said when he grabbed this creature in the headlock and started punching it in the head, he said the only way I could describe it is that it was a creature I was fighting, but it was invisible. He couldn't see what he was hitting, but he had a hold of something, and something had a hold of him. And he was hitting it with the back of his flashlight when the creature bounced his head off of one of the stones, and he passed out. When he woke up an hour later, he was laying in the middle of the chamber with the flashlight still in his hand, and he didn't know what the hell happened to him. And he got out of there, and he never looked back. So when we went there, you know, not knowing what we were going to find, and Cindy already had a bad energy. Like I said, we had to leave two guys home that night. And when we got there, there was another woman with us who's a sensitive. And she wouldn't even cross over the street to go into the chamber. She said, no, I'm not going over there. I don't like the energy of this place. But we went in and we did our investigation. And again, couldn't see anything, you know, with our regular eyes. We didn't see anything with our regular cameras. We took tons of pictures. But when we actually started taking photographs in infrared, there was an image on one of the stones that looked like the face of the devil himself.
Mm.
And it looked like it was chiseled in, like something you would have seen from ancient Rome or something. But the crazy thing is, though it looked like it was chiseled into the stone, if you touched the stone with your hand, it was smooth to the touch.
Hmm.
And once everybody seen that image, everybody decided that, you know, maybe we should back out of that chamber and just leave well enough alone, because nobody really had a good vibe going in. And it just had its own strange energy compared to all the other chambers.
Yeah.
This one had a different energy to it, for sure.
Did any of that wind up in one of Phil's books? Because I've got several of his books.
Yeah, I believe it did wind up in one of his books. but I can't remember the title of the book offhand. Because I read a bunch of Phil's books.
Yeah, me too. Know. He did some incredible investigations in the 80s.
Yes. He's what you can say what you want about the guy as far as, you know, MIT story and all that other stuff.
Yeah, just a misstep.
But as far as an investigator goes, he was an amazing investigator.
Yeah, because they didn't have the electronic gadgets then. So he was very enterprising in what he did.
Yeah, I did. And when I go out with my team, I always bring old school, new school stuff with me.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I get more results with the old school stuff than I do with the new school stuff. I really do.
I believe that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Most of the new school stuff. I was just going to say, most of the new school stuff is just gadgets anyway, don't you think?
they're all supposed to work as certain principles, you know what I mean? I assume the engineers who built them, the electronic engineers, know what they're talking about. But the difference between the old school stuff and the new school stuff is if you're standing there with a K2 meter and the lights are going off all different colors, that's amazing. But if you're standing there with dowsing rods and the dowsing rods are spinning like helicopter blades and you feel that energy in your hands go through your body, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah, it is.
To actually feel it, you know, and that's what I like. I like playing with the dowsing rods or even a crystal pendulum, you know. You can feel that energy go right through that pendulum up the chain and into your fingertips.
Yeah.
That's the one thing you don't get with the new school stuff, the toys, all the electronic stuff. You don't feel anything.
It's helpful, but you don't feel anything.
Yeah.
Sort of takes a personal experience away, almost. Cindy, does she have varying ideas on the purpose of the stone chambers? Like, why did she think that those two little evil entities were in that domed chamber? Did she have any idea?
I don't remember discussing that with her.
Okay.
So I really can't comment on it. But like she said, she feels that they were built thousands of years ago for religious observance, you know, whether that being sacrifice, human sacrifice, or according to Linda Zimmerman, who's been to the chambers herself, and she's an amazing investigator, she says they all line up to some kind of equinox, whether it be summer equinox or winter equinox. She's a big believer that they were built by the Native Americans and that they were built to track the seasons and everything, but I don't know.
I believe that
they do face the winter equinox and the summer equinox, but I don't know if that was all they were built for.
There are so many different structures. There were cairns, and then there were chambers, and then there were, you know, circular ceremonial centers that with single stones that mark off different directions. So I think that there may be a really large complex, and then there seem to be smaller, more minor complexes or structures nearby or within certain alignments to the main structure. That's what seems to happen. They're all over the northeast.
Oh,
thank you for elaborating on that, because I find the stone chamber stories really intriguing. The whole thing is just a big mystery right now, because we really don't know just yet, you know, what they're all about.
And every time we go to the chambers, we always have some kind of experience. The last time I was out at the King's Chamber, we were doing I was actually filming with the IR camera, and two of my investigators were outside the front door, but I was at the back of the chamber about 35 feet away from them, and I heard somebody literally growl at me and then tell me to get out, and I heard audibly with my own two ears. I didn't hear, you know, that didn't, but the crazy thing is that it was so loud that I actually went outside to my two investigators, Anthony and Frank, and I said, "Did you guys hear that?" And it's like, "Did you hear what?" said, did you hear that Get Out? I said, it was so loud that you guys had to hear it. And they were like, no, Al, you know, we were changing batteries on their equipment because it kept killing our batteries. And I said, yeah, so I thought I had captured it on the IR camera, but for some reason or another, the microphone on the IR camera, which is super sensitive, didn't capture the growl that day or the Get Out.
So you definitely heard it with your ears.
Audibly, yes. I heard a growl, like a dog growl, mm-hmm. and then I heard Get Out.
I've heard the Get Out in my mind, but I haven't heard it with my ears. But I know exactly what you're talking about. It's pretty frightening. But that's amazing that only you heard it, and they didn't,
yeah,
and that it didn't record.
I had a periscope wand with me, which is really super sensitive to negative and positive ions. And I was sitting in the middle of the chamber, and while those guys were filming me, trying to get some kind of responses, and that thing did not go off at all for me. As soon as I handed off to Frank or Anthony, that periscope wand went off like a Christmas tree. It was lit up the whole time they were in there, but it wouldn't answer me. It wouldn't do anything for me. So apparently they didn't like my energy.
Didn't like your attitude.
Maybe. I don't know. My New York attitude, I guess. I don't know.
Well, you said that you were at the King and the Queen's chambers. Same structure, just two different chambers inside the structure? Or are they two different structures?
They're two different chambers altogether.
Okay, and who named them like that?
To the north of the Queen's chamber, and it's like three times the size of it.
And where does the name come from? Just whoever mapped out the chambers?
Yes, whoever mapped them out. I guess they decided because this chamber, it had a standing stone in front of it. And it's just kind of sitting up on a ridge overlooking a plateau that almost looks like where you would stand to address a gathering of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like looking down, I could see someone standing either in front of the chamber or up on top of the chamber, addressing a group of people just sitting down in this plateau. It was like in the shape of a bowl. It was just, and the Queen's Chamber was just over the ridge on the other side. It was just smaller. That's why they called it the Queen's Chamber. But the Queen's Chamber had a standing stone as well.
I've never heard of that, like a standing stone sort of in front of the doorway.
Off to the left of the doorway, yes.
Oh, I haven't heard of that. I'd love to see that.
It's almost like an obelisk in the shape of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm reading a book right now by Glenn Kreisberg, and he's got different contributing authors that give their theories and their scientific study on the purpose of these stones, and they get down to the electromagnetism of them and the alignments. It's fascinating stuff, but it's very, very technical. So I have to keep rereading it over again. But everything's coming together. There's a lot of agreement. Do you suppose we have time a little bit to get into Nuclear Lake?
Well, I could tell you a couple of quick tidbits about Nuclear Lake. Yeah,
okay.
I can't get into anything deep because there's a couple of Nuclear Lake stories that can go on for an hour by themselves. But
okay.
I can tell you about the last two times we were there really quickly.
Which is in New York, right?
Yeah, Nuclear Lake is in New York. The name of the lake is called Nuclear Lake because they used to mine uranium there, and they used to refine it on site. And there was an accident. It spilled into the lake, and henceforth, Nuclear Lake.
And this was what, about World War II or one?
No, this was in the 70s.
In the 70s, okay.
Yes. United Mining Corp, I believe, was the company that was actually had the contract with the government. But after the accident, they canceled the contract, and they spent like $8 million cleaning up the lake and the surrounding area. But we find it to be a place of high strangeness. There's a lot of Sasquatch sightings there. There's a lot of UFO sightings there. There's people see these orbs in the woods. You know, because the Appalachian Trail runs right through there. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of traffic that goes through. People are always hiking on the Appalachian Trail, and there's like one particular spot at Nuclear Lake down by the lake that would be, that's considered like a campsite where people camp. And that's where they have all these experiences. But we actually found a sacred site up on a high plateau that's got giant megalithic stones set up in a circle with hundreds of stones on top of all the megalithic stones. And it has archways and X's and twists and breaks. And there's a lot of Sasquatch evidence there. And I took a good friend of mine there one time. He wanted to go squatching, and I took him there. And I said, okay, which is me and him in the middle of the woods. And I said, okay, just relax and let these creatures come to us, because I believe they live on a ridge line just north of us. And they come down off the ridge when they hear people at the site and to see what's going on. So we're sitting there, and I'm sitting underneath this archway. And the energy at this place is so relaxing that I could sleep underneath that archway in a sleeping bag and not worry about anything happening to me. The energy is so good there. And I was sitting underneath the archway, and my friend Danny was sitting to my south. He was looking over my shoulder. I was looking over his shoulder. And he pulled up the binoculars, not the binoculars, the night vision goggles, and he seen... he thought was about a 7-foot Sasquatch about 25 feet behind me standing next to a tree. And he started to freak out, and I said, Dan, don't freak out. This is a sacred site. Nothing's going to happen here. We've been here many times. We've never had any incidences. Don't worry about it. And about 5 minutes later, he pulled the binoculars up again, and now the creature was about 15 feet from me at a different location. And at one point it got to about 7 feet from me. And but the whole reason the creature came in is because at one point during the course of the night, and this is crazy, I had a digital voice recorder going on one of the megalithic stones, and I had the IR camera going at the same time. We decided to do a Native American ceremony to draw him in. And we did the flute and the tom-toms, and we did a ceremony, and we drew him in. And I believe they thought there may have been something going on at the site, so they came down. They sent the scout down to see us. So while we were there, all night long, I'm doing 360s with the digital camera, going around 360, taking photographs. Nothing in any of the photographs all night long. After we do the Indian ceremony, I got two photographs with about 30 orbs in each of the photographs. And the orbs look like they have faces in it. This was right after the ceremony. At our evidence review, we were reviewing the tape, and on the digital voice recorder, you can hear Danny and myself do the ceremony. But on the tape, but on the microphone from the IR camera, which must be set to a different frequency, you can hear a whole Native ceremony going on behind us.
You're kidding.
It sounded like there was 10 drums going off at the same time. When Danny, because Danny's not a member of our team, but Danny was invited to the evidence review because he was there that night. When Danny heard that, he fell off his chair. He couldn't believe. And I said, well, why did we catch it on one but not the other? And according to Brian, who's my tech guy, he said, you know, one set up to it, they must be set up to different frequencies.
Well, how did you set the microphone to a different frequency to catch it?
Well, I guess it's set that way by the manufacturer.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah,
okay.
You know how a lot of times you get an EVP on one recorder, but there'll be another one right next to it that doesn't get anything.
But
right.
It could be the same recorder. So if it's the same recorder, it wouldn't have different frequencies, would it?
Yeah.
No, but the camera and the digital voice recorder were two different makes.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense to me.
That is
amazing.
Yeah,
so
it was amazing. And then Brian calls me up because Brian's been doing this
remote viewing
with Cindy, and he says, I don't know if this means anything, but I see a white flash and a blue light, and take it for what it's worth, but that's what I see. I said, okay, we'll take it for what it's worth. Well, after a couple hours in the woods, you know, we decided to call it a night. As we're leaving, Danny says, hey, Al, take me down the Appalachian Trail where those coyotes ran over your feet that time. I had a coyotes run over my legs when we were squatching one night. So we go off onto the Appalachian Trail, and then we start finding all kinds of wood structures off the trail. So now we're off the trail, and we're taking pictures of all these wood structures, these lean-tos and these teepees and archways and X-ways, and we're off the beaten path. And we decide, I said, you know what, we're getting too far off the beaten path. Let's go back to the Appalachian Trail. When we went back to the Appalachian Trail, Danny happened to be in front of me. And as he turned to exit the trail, I seen him jolt back, like his knees buckled and his head went back, and he looked like he got shot with a high-powered rifle. So I went to catch him, and he actually was able to catch himself. And I leaned him up against a tree, and I said, Dan, what happened, you know? And he said, I don't know. All of a sudden, I seen a bright flash of light a white light and a blue flash go through my body. He said it went through my left hand, through my fingertips, through my body, and out my right hand. I said it felt like an electrical charge. And it just, so he goes, what do you think happened? And I said, I think you may have just gotten hit with some infrasound from these creatures, because, you know, we're wandering off the trail and we're headed, you know, maybe in there.
Yeah, like a no trespassing.
Yeah, and yeah. They just wanted us out of there, and I don't know if that infrasound was meant for me or for him, but he happened to be standing in front of me at the time, so he got hit with it. You know, and I told him, I said, listen, you go home tonight and you're bleeding, you check your urine, you're bleeding and stuff like that. This is serious stuff. Go to the hospital, you know, don't take this lightly. But he never had any issues with any of, you know, any issues from the results of that. So that was one quick story. Another story, I took a bunch of two ghost hunting girls out with me. They wanted to go squatching. It was on their bucket list. And took them to the sacred site. And again, we're there. And I set up a perimeter of glow sticks around us, like 10 feet around us, so we have some ambient light. And all of a sudden, you could hear the creatures coming in off the ridgeline, and they're really stomping heavy, boom, 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 and it's totally surrounded us. And the girls were freaking out, and I told them, I said, don't freak out, because this is the sacred site, nothing's going to happen to us here. As a matter of fact, one of the girls was a sensitive, and while she was walking around the site when we got there originally, she came across a Native American spirit of a young woman who asked her if she knew where her tribe was. And she said, no. She said, can I stay here at the site in case my tribe comes back? And she said, of course you can stay here. So she came back and she relayed that message to us. So anyway, as it's getting darker and darker and it's getting really, you know, scary, they start doing tree knocks and whoops and rock knocks, and they start throwing rocks at us. By the handful, the rocks are coming in.
Now, you do see that as negative, don't you?
No, I don't see that as negative.
No?
I don't see it as negative at all. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying gently to escort you to leave.
It's
that time where they want to do their hunting and you're in their way, mm-hmm. and they want you to leave.
Okay.
So they're throwing these rocks at us, but the rocks are not hitting any of us. They're landing all around us. And then at one point, one of them grabs a big tree and breaks the tree. Now this tree, when it snapped, it sounded like a gun going off. At that point, I said, "Okay, it's time for us to leave."
Yeah,
we packed up our gear. We headed out. We're walking down the mining road. We're hiking out, and you can hear whistling on either side of us. And one of the girls who's a sensitive says, "You know, we're being followed." And I said, "Yeah, they're herding us out. They want us out of here." And they're herding us out, and there's one behind us, directly behind us on the mining road, pretending to be a barred owl. He's doing hoots, and the other two are doing whistles. But the energy I'm getting is that these are not the big guys that just chase us out of the sacred site. These are like juveniles just pushing us out, you know? That's their job. Get them out of here. So as we're leaving, we get to a point on the mining road where we're still about a mile away, because we're about 4 miles in the woods at this point. Now we're about a mile away from the ranger station as we're leaving, and all of a sudden, the one that's way behind us comes charging up, comes running up the mining road, and I guess when he reached a certain point, the other two jumped out. Now we got three of these juveniles all doing monkey barking. Ooh, 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 ooh,
oh,
ooh,
no.
Ooh. And the woods go deathly silent, and the monkey barking is going through the trees. One of the girls takes off running. I tell her to stop. Don't run. That's the worst thing you could do. The other girl looks at me. She says, "That's Al, your eyes are as big as saucers." I said, "I've never experienced anything like this before." I said, "Now, I don't know what's going on. I got all this stuff going through my mind in like a thousandth of a second. I'm thinking, I'm trying. I've turned my headlamp on to get them in my headlamp because I want to see them. Because I'm feeling the energy I'm getting is that they're juveniles and they're just trying to scare the girls." Okay? That's the first vibe I got. But they're jumping up and down and they're slapping the road and you can feel the vibration come all the way down the road and their barking is going right through you. I mean, it's literally going right through you.
Yeah.
So at one point, I felt it got to such a feverish pitch that I thought it went from being like scaring us to maybe getting excited. Now, I don't know if these were three males that smelled the girls and got excited, or three females who smelled the girls and were pissed that there were other women in the woods. But I felt as the alpha male with the two girls, I had to do something. All I had on me was a machete, a survival knife, and a flare gun. So I said, "Should I shoot the flare gun over their head so I could get a look at them?" "No, I don't want to do that. I don't want to burn the woods down. Should I shoot the flare gun on the mining road? It's concrete. At least I can see what they look like." But I said, "God forbid I set one on fire, then the other two will kill me." So I said, "Okay, I got to do something because I feel like these creatures are about to come charging down the road." So I pull out my survival knife and I make sure that they can see it. I got it in my headlamp so that the blade is shining. And I start walking towards them and I start screaming at them. And I'm telling them to knock it off. That's enough. We're already leaving. There's no reason to act like this. You're not going to chase us out of the woods. We're going to leave on our own track. And I'm just screaming like a maniac in the woods at three apes. And eventually one of the girls said, "Al, please stop walking towards them. Come back to us, you know?" But I could never get them in my headlamp. So I don't know if they were backing up as I was walking towards them or if they had jumped back into the woods to hide behind a tree or a rock or something. But after that, we turned, and I said, "Now we're going to walk out, and we're going to walk out our own pace, and we're not going to let them chase us out of the woods." And as we started to walk, we got about a half a mile when the girl, sensitive one, said, "Out, they're not following us anymore. Whatever you did, you scared them off."
Huh.
And that was an experience that I had never experienced before in my life.
I think that they could make themselves invisible, you know?
Well, I think I have a theory that they can change the spectrum of light they're in.
Yeah.
Manipulate the spectrum of light. I don't know if they, you know, if they can
something disappear, like that.
But I think they can do something like that where they can manipulate the light spectrum so that we can't see them in our spectrum of light.
There's a movie out called The Predator, and apparently that sort of thing does happen where you can almost make the creature out, but it's like a rippling effect. You got to see the movie, but you can't clearly see the creature, but you can almost see the outline of it. And I think
gotcha.
It's the same thing that they're doing. But Al, we are at the bottom of the hour. We're going to have to say goodbye. This has been wonderful.
And we thank you very much, Al, for staying up so late. You probably got to get up in the morning. I don't know, but
well, actually, I'm out of work right now. I'm out. I just had some cancer surgery, but I'm okay. I'm okay. Everything is good.
And good.
I'm just recovering from surgery, but I otherwise it would definitely be past my bedtime.
Well, right. Thank you very much then for doing this.
Yes, we thank you very much, Al.
Hope you're feeling better.
Oh, I am feeling better. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. Anytime. Don't hesitate.
Okay. It was great. Great having you. Great stories.
Wonderful stories. And thank you so much,
thank you.
Al. All
okay.
right.
Okay.
You have a good evening.
Thank you, Al. Have a good night.
Good night. Good night, everybody. Good night.
Okay. Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience on WSCA 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
And everyone, thank you for listening, and you have a great evening.
in this one of many possible worlds. All for the best, or some bizarre test. It is what it is, and whatever. Time is still the infinite jest. The arrow flies when you dream. The hours tick away, the cells tick away. The watchmaker keeps to his schemes. The hours tick away, they tick away. The measure of a life is a measure of...